All right, so I've been charged with the task of giving you an introduction to these non-abelian plasma instabilities. And if you don't know, my name's Michael Strickland, and I'm currently residing in Frankfurt in Germany. So why the hell is there such an interest in these plasma instabilities at RIC and also at LHC? This particular graph sort of shows the time scales and what I call the epochs, which are the different kinds of matter which exist during a heavy ion collision, and it's quite complicated. The units here are given in Fermi over C, which for those who don't know, this is something on the order of 3×10⁻²³ seconds. And the top of this graph is essentially at LHC energies, about 18 Fermi over C. So we're talking about an event which lasts about 10⁻²² seconds on that order of magnitude. And the question is, will the plasma become thermalized and be describable in terms of hydrodynamics and things like this within this extremely short time scale, given the fact that I have some high energy nucleon flying over here, the other high energy nucleon flying over here, and then the matter in between is expanding out at almost the speed of light initially. It could be that the matter would become so dilute that it wouldn't interact with itself enough to become thermalized. It could just fly away to the detectors, in which you would just get a free streaming explosion of the matter. You can kind of break down the time evolution of a heavy ion collision into at least five different regimes. There's this very early time, which is before essentially the partons are even formed. You can even think about saying that you have quarks and gluons in the plasma. Before that, they're not even on-shell particles around. And in this red region here, it's more applicable to use a field description instead of any kind of transport or particle description. At some point in time, however, you go through some non-equilibrium phase, which these are just estimates. Don't take these as the word of God how long these time intervals last. And so there's some period in which the QGP is non-equilibrium, and then some longer period, hopefully, in which it's in equilibrium and can be described by all the calculations which have been done in the past for an equilibrized quark-gluon plasma. At some later time, this stuff cools down, and then the description in terms of a quark-gluon plasma is no longer valid, and it becomes a hot hadron gas, which lives for some time. And then after that, those hadrons bang into one another. They chemically equilibrate, and eventually they free stream to the detectors, and that's what you see. Yes?
This last phase seems very unlikely to me, because the hadron gas has not sufficiently strong interaction to keep in equilibrium. But one observes in chemical freeze-out equilibrium distributions. So somehow this last phase either must be extremely short or inexistent.
Great. I mean, I haven't even put how long that lasts there, because I'm not going to focus on this. I'm going to focus on this.
At lower energies, you don't have quark-gluon plasma, and you have equilibrium.
Yeah, but you have no hadron interactions that are strong enough.
No, you have
not in order to keep it in equilibrium.
Why?
Or this phase does not exist. This last one, that's a simple explanation. This is not his topic.
So yes. I have to give an overview, so I have to show you that this is quite complicated, and there are many issues about exactly these late time phases. And in fact, lots of uncertainties are introduced by how exactly this late-time phase is modeled. And next Friday, I'll talk about trying to find observables which aren't sensitive to this late-time phase, but are instead primarily sensitive to this early-time phase in order to remove these ambiguities. But that's not the focus for today. The focus for today is what happens in this time scale between 0.1 and something on the order of 2 Fermi over C. Now, the motivation and goal for this is to try to understand isotropization and thermalization of a quark gluon plasma at weak coupling, and then do something sketchy and extrapolate back to G's on the order of 2 or alpha S on the order of 0.3. The relevant processes from a kind of transport theory picture include 2-to-2 scattering. If you do this in an expanding system, this takes exponentially long to equilibrate a quark gluon plasma. In order to get it to equilibrate in a finite time, you have to include these inelastic processes, some Bremsstrom process and a fusion process, so 2-to-3 and 3-to-2. And even when you do this, you have to include the effects of soft background fields. And the expansion, which comes in from the covariant derivative, is in G times A, not in G. And so you really have to worry about what is the magnitude of these the vector potential A that's flying around. If it's true what CGC, this colored glass condensate, which describes this red region here, if it's true what these calculations find, these occupation numbers are on the order of 1 over G, and so you can't, it's highly non-perturbative, you know, even if G is small. The problem that earlier calculations have is that in equilibrium, these background fields basically only serve to screen the interaction. But in non-equilibrium, these background fields can have highly trivial, non-trivial dynamics. And
something about that? You speak too loud.
Yes. Keeping it under control, don't worry. And these background fields can then have a large effect on the particle's motion. So the previous estimates, quote-unquote best in the world perturbative estimates from these Beyer, Mueller, Sonne, and Schiff, it goes under the name of bottom-up thermalization, and they include exactly this 2-to-2, 2-to-3, and 3-to-2 processes. And it's a rather complicated multi-stage process. In the end, their conclusion is that the thermalization time for a quark gluon plasma is some funny power of alpha S to the minus 13.5, times this the inverse nuclear saturation scale. You can think of this as basically the average transverse momentum in the nucleonic wave function. And this is something that comes out basically from these CGC calculations. At RIC, this scale QS is some number on the order of 1.5 to 2 GeV. And if you then plug in alpha S is 0.3, which is approximately what it is if the temperature is generated at RIC, then you get a thermalization time on the order of 2 to 3 Fermi over C. In some sense, this is an astounding success because the thing actually thermalized within the lifetime of the matter that you were trying to create. However, there have been certain hydrofits which in the past have been suggesting that this thermalization time was more on the order of a half Fermi over C. So this has been propagated around our community as an extreme failure of perturbative QCD, when in fact even getting a number within a factor of 2, I think, is an astounding success. However, one thing that they did ignore in the bottom-up calculation is the effect of local anisotropy in momentum space, and I'll tell you how that arises on the next slide, and how that those local anisotropies affect the soft physics, or these kind of classical fields, which are in the background. And as I'll try to prove to you and show you analytic and numerical results, in such anisotropic systems, a new kind of phenomenon arises, and there are plasma instabilities. And I can say with fair certainty that they will accelerate isotropization and thermalization. The question in our community is by how much? Precisely a quantitative question.
So one thing that confuses me about that statement is usually instabilities drive you away from it.
Right. Yeah, I'll try to get to that.
Just a question. So his last part is relevant only for the rig physics, or it could be relevant also for putting it in a kind of cosmological context?
Well, I think he would have to have some anisotropy in momentum space. And I'm not sure in a cosmological context where that would arise.
So next week I will speak on similar things in cosmological context. It's true, the original instability is different. The other one is very similar after you have instability.
Okay, so here's a cartoon picture. On the bottom here is the proper time, and on the vertical axis is the average longitudinal momentum of the partons in the plasma scaled with the average transverse momentum. If you go to the very earliest times where this kind of colored glass condensate, and they have a new word for it, glasma, picture holds, actually at this point in time, the momentum distribution is much more elongated along the beam line than transverse. This is simply the fact that you've just taken two nuclei and slammed them together. You broke the rotational symmetry.
What do you know
then? Huh? Well, I mean, you can just count partons in the nuclei, and they only have momentum in longitudinal direction originally. They fly apart, and that's it.
Yes, but in the produced plasma, I mean,
right. Well, the other way you can see it, right, is, well, this early stage is not really a plasma. It's this glasma thing. Yeah. I mean, so what the CGC guys do is they assume that the partons in the nuclei, and this is very good for describing this low-X soft gluon stuff, they assume that the partons and the neutrons in the nuclei actually just fly along iconal trajectories and basically radiate off this soft field which gets generated here. Now, whether that assumption is valid, it's certainly valid in the infinite energy limit. As you extrapolate down to Rick energies, this is questionable, of course.
Well, you also have evidence to the elliptic flow, right? If you start in something, presumably elongated.
Well, this is in a different plane than the elliptic flow. Elliptic flow is in this plane. And I'm talking about anisotropies in the PTPL plane now. Different plane. So, as the system expands, and if you're a cosmologist, you can kind of think of this as a one-dimensional Hubble expansion. So all of the longitudinal momentum in the system are going to get redshifted. So they'll get lowered. But eventually, the interactions in the theory will start to kick in, hopefully. And they'll turn this curve around and drive it back towards a state which is approximately isotropic in the PLPT plane. And once that's achieved, then you could have some hope to apply viscous hydro. Before that, you hope that maybe perhaps something like Boltzmann-Vlasov transport will be valid. Now, to use Boltzmann-Vlasov transport, you have to have on-shell particles and these background fields. To get on-shell particles, you have to wait for their formation time. So I have my two nuclei flying apart here, and these little yellow dots are the gluons that form. The guys that have the largest longitudinal momentum have the largest formation time, and they form out here at very large rapidity, and the guys that have the smallest longitudinal momentum have the shortest formation time, and they form here at this central line. So basically, the system kind of selects out, if you were to look at this y equal to zero line, only these guys which have very small longitudinal momentum. Now, if it was truly free streaming, this curve would continue to go down and this ratio would go to zero. Now, what you want to know is how are the collective modes of the system now affected by...
Yes? Why would it go to zero?
Because
free streaming, you would guess at the end.
Well, one-dimensional free streaming.
Once they are far away, you know, they just have a given momentum. They will not lose it anymore. No, it will go to a constant, I would say.
Well, the longitudinal momentum scales like 1 over the proper time, and the PT stays at the scale QS.
This kind of ratio, below 1 was never seen at any energy in any size system. I mean, it has been looked systematically, and the lowest that was found in your ratio, it would be like 1.3. For not local, it's not global, in global system proper.
This is the local momentum space.
I know that this is local, but over there there's much less spreading rapidity. Yeah.
So that's certainly true. I mean, at lower energies, you have more nuclear stopping power, so basically everything just sort of sticks together.
It maximizes and then goes away.
Yeah. At high energies, this goes away, and you get more of a picture where a dip will develop.
It's very
and
exciting.
The quantitative question is, how far will it go down, and how fast will it go back up to something close?
From the low energy point of view, it's extremely exotic.
Yes. I will not argue that at SPS or AGS energies that this would be more, but I don't know. So if it was a truly isotropic plasma, there are analytic results known from either linearized transport theory or diagrammatics, known as the hard thermal loop perturbation theory, which give you exactly the collective modes of the system. In the isotropic plasma, you get some longitudinal plasma mode, a transverse plasma mode, and they're just stable modes which propagate through the system with a certain dispersion relation. So then you can ask the question, if I repeated that analysis, but now assumed that I take an arbitrary my arbitrary particle distribution, which depends on, say, momentum and position, and I expand it now about a distribution that's not isotropic in momentum space, but has some dependence on p vector, and then some small fluctuation on top of that, you can then derive essentially equations of motions for these fluctuations to see how they would evolve in time. In terms of equations, this comes out to some linearized Boltzmann-Vlasov equation. This is a covariant derivative. This is the normalized four velocity of your partons. This is the fluctuation on top of this anisotropic background. This is your normal field strength tensor. And this couples into some derivative in momentum space of this the particle distribution itself. On the right, I set here, for now, zero. That means I ignore collisions in the plasma between the partons. I will justify this a priori, I mean, after the fact, rather, a posteriori. You have to then couple these particle fluctuations back into the Yang-Mills equations by taking those, integrating over momentum, essentially, times their velocity and their charge, or their coupling here, yeah, to get the current, which then couples back into the Yang-Mills equation. And you have to solve these two simultaneously. You could also do another thing, which is to do it diagrammatically, and you can just calculate in, say, pure glue, the gluon polarization tensor. Now, assuming that on these external legs, you have something in our terminology which is called a soft momentum, this is only strictly, the scale separation only exists in the weakly coupled limit. In that limit, there's two kinds of scales. There's p hard, which is the average momentum of the particles in the system. In an equilibrium system, this is the temperature. In a non-equilibrium system, you just have to compute some average over the distribution function to define this p hard. But then there seem to come out two scales, g times this p hard and p hard itself. And if you want to know what is the gluon propagator on these soft scales, g times p hard, to leading order, it suffices to consider graphs like this and then expand them and include only the hard momentum, which in equilibrium which would be a momentum on the order of the temperature, in these loops. And then you just write down these integral expressions for the polarization tensor, and what drops out is some expression like this. And you could do it this way or this way, you get the exact same expression. It's not surprising because these are somehow fundamentally linked, but you always want to make the check. What results is some integral, which you have to do to get pi, which is not very useful. There's an arbitrary distribution function here, which now depends on the three momentum, and then some complicated tensor kernel. It's a diagonal in this case in color space, so it's essentially abelian at this linear level. You can then try to play some games. You could have just plugged in your favorite f of p vector into that equation and calculated pi, but then people might argue with you, well, my f of p vector is better than your f of p vector, and you would never come to agreement about whether the physics that you discovered was universal. So back in 2003, Paul and I just made a very simple trick, which is we take an arbitrary isotropic distribution function f, which now only depends on p vector squared, and deform it by changing the argument from p squared to p squared with some anisotropy parameter, c here, times p dot n. N here you can just think of as the beam line. So this is the direction that the original nuclei were flying in along. A positive Kasi here corresponds to squishing this distribution in momentum space. As Kasi goes to infinity, it's a two-dimensional sheet, with partons only flying up and down. When Kasi goes to minus one, it's this other limit, this sausage, the prolate distribution, in which they're all flying along this n-hat direction. The nice thing about this trick is that you can plug this into that expression I showed you on the previous slide, and it turns out you can make a change of variables and actually do the length of p integration, and what's left over is just an angular integral, which now has that same kernel, tensor kernel here, and then something which depends on this parameter c. What comes out of that trick is that outside you just get one scale, which is actually the isotropic Debye mass of the system, which is determined from this arbitrary isotropic function that you plugged in the first place. So at this point, every result that is derived only comes from this angular integral, and there's just a scale, which in principle is just depends on this function. Parametrically, this Debye mass is just g squared times this scale, which I introduced on the previous slide, p hard, in equilibrium, md squared is something like g squared t squared. Once you have this expression for pi ij, you can decompose it into a tensor basis, find the collective modes, and what you find is for C is greater than zero, which is this oblate distribution, that there are new collective modes here indicated by red X's than you would have gotten in the isotropic case here indicated by black X's. In the isotropic case, you just get a longitudinal mode and a transverse mode. In the anisotropic case, you get another stable mode, but the interesting thing is two new modes pop up on the imaginary axis. Two in the upper half plane and two in the lower half planes. These are not so interesting, they're damped. You might ask, where do these modes come from? They actually come from a higher Riemann sheet and come through the cut. They exist also in the isotropic case, but they're on higher Riemann sheets. And they correspond, they map directly onto this what's called dynamical magnetic screening of the gluons. So you can, just like you can extract a dispersion relation for a stable mode, which you vary the momentum and then you measure the energy, basically the position of these x's as a function of momentum, you can do the same for these unstable modes. And what you get out is this unstable mode spectrum. So this plotted here is essentially how far up on that on the imaginary axis those poles are as a function of momentum. And what you find is that here everything is scaled by this k over this Debye mass, and it's all numbers basically on the order of one. You find that there's some finite range of unstable modes in the system, which are soft. That's good, because the theory that you had developed was for soft momentum. If you had found that there were hard unstable modes, you wouldn't trust it, because your effective theory doesn't apply to hard modes. But in this case, these unstable modes are confined to the soft sector. And the instability growth rate here scales like this Debye mass. So gamma is something like g times this hard scale. So it's an electric effect in some sense in the thermal equilibrium language. Because this has a peak at some finite momentum, what that means is after a certain amount of time, the system will be dominated by modes with the wave number k star growing at a rate gamma star. And this causes the system to do what's called filamentation, which I'll return to later. So for this to be relevant at RIC, you have to then estimate the time scale, RIC or LHC, the time scale for how fast would this instability develop. So we try to then plug in some numbers. You take alpha S as 0.3 again, QS is 1.5. You can do it two different ways. Just plug it into this a kind of naive formula for MD, which is G times P hard, and then you get some estimate this way, or you can take CGC estimates for the gluon density and try to compute the divine mass that way. You get slightly smaller numbers, so the full range here for this MD is something between 2 and 4, so up to a factor of 2. And then folding this together with the with this numerical factor here, whatever the peak value of gamma star is, you get an e-folding time of something on the order of 0.1 to 0.4 Fermi over C. So it's within the window of time which these kind of heavy ion collisions will sample. Now, this is all strictly only applicable in the weak coupling limit. So you want to ask, well, what are the time scales, right? So what I told you is that this instability time scale is proportional to this inverse Debye mass, which is basically the square root of alpha s times qs. The next time scale down, which is relevant, is the time scale for hard collisions. And that comes from just some binary scattering diagram. So it goes like the inverse of alpha s squared qs. You can then take the ratio of these two time scales. And what you see, a very, very small coupling, the time, essentially, for a collision to happen is 1,000 times the time scale for the instability. And if this is an exponentially growing thing, you can basically ignore collisions then, if alpha s is very tiny. Then the instability becomes really the driving thing. At alpha s is 0.1, so something around the z mass, you get a ratio of these scales around 30. At that mass, I would say, then again, you probably could ignore collisions because you just had 30 e-foldings of some unstable field. It becomes a little sketchy, and you now have to do real numerical simulations. When you plug it up, you plug in alpha s is 0.3, then the ratio of these two time scales comes out to some number on the order of 1 to 10. Now, you can include collisions in here by putting in a collision term on the right-hand side of your Boltzmann-Vlasov equation, and I did that together with my graduate student Bjorn Schenk and Carsten Greiner and Markus Thoma. And we found basically that even at alpha s is 0.3, you get, unstable modes like this. The growth rate is slightly lower, but they're still there.
We have to think about what the collision kernel you have to put in,
yes.
Because if some of the modes are very large, then you may include more than 2 to 2 processes or so.
What the low modes you simulate by this classical theory, and those you automatically include end-to-end scattering, essentially, through solving the equations of motion. For the hard modes, hopefully those have still low occupation number, and then you should, in principle, only have to include 2 to 2, but of course it's...
For which alpha s do the instabilities disappear?
If you want to completely make them go away, I think you have to pump this up to something like 1, and then they don't exist at all. So now I'm going to try to give you a kind of Jackson-level explanation for what is this instability in the first place, because looking at these formulas, most people, including myself, when I first got involved in this, couldn't really understand what was going on. For this, I'm used to being on this side, so I should move over, because you got to get the right-hand rule right. So we imagine some system in which we have a large amount of PT and not very much PL. So basically just partons flying up and down in this plane. Yeah. And here, for simplicity, I choose positively charged, in this case, abelian electric charge. And these guys are just flying up down here. And I imagine that on top of this bunch of particles flying just up and down, I put some small magnetic perturbation, which is going in and out of the board. Out of the board here, into the board here, as indicated by the little arrows up there. And then you can just do Jackson and try to compute what are the forces. You stick your finger along the current, you compute the force this way because the magnetic field is going into the board. And you do the same for this guy, and you get the forces pushing in that way. What you find is if you repeat this all over by moving these plus charges around into various regions of the of the background magnetic field is that all of these up-moving particles get pushed into these red regions, and all of the down-moving particles get pushed into these blue regions. I mean, they don't do this nicely. They're still oscillating around it. But they get pushed into these regions. And then, once they get pushed into the region, into these filaments, you can then ask, well, what's the induced field from this? So then again, this white arrow here is the induced field, here indicated by, the induced current, sorry, indicated here by this red line here. So using, again, Maxwell, you're supposed to stick your thumb along the direction of the current, and the magnetic field curves around that. Yeah? But surprisingly, you find that that's exactly the orientation of the magnetic field that you put on to begin with. So this filamentation actually reinforces the background magnetic fluctuation. And this results in a runway because essentially they just start getting focused more and more in the filaments. They generate more and more magnetic field. And so this wouldn't naively lead to an isotropic thermal state. The way that works in a QED plasma, and this is the bane of many a tokamak physicist's life, is that these guys are really wiggling around in here. And this whole effective theory that I described to you is only applicable when the deflections by the field are small, on the order of theta, around g. When this field grows to where that deflection is bigger than order g, or order 1, the whole picture that I described to you breaks down. What happens actually is these guys basically start wiggling around in these filaments, and eventually they get enough longitudinal momentum that they just go shooting out. And this is observed in many QED simulations. Any questions on that? Because this is, if you understand this, then you understand why there's an instability.
Could you think of this as laminar flow? An increase in the magnetic field become turbulent?
Well, in this case, it doesn't become turbulent. I don't know at late times what would happen because...
But as he said, this picture is only good for the original instability. After it's there, it becomes non-linear, and then this whole picture breaks down.
Yeah, I'll show you later that in QCD it does end up in a kind of turbulent phase, but so that's completely different.
Why the oblong distribution?
That's just to make this picture easy to talk about. If it was an isotropic distribution, what happens is you have a bunch of guys flying this way, and what they do is deplete that magnetic field, and the net magnetic field that's generated is zero. And you can prove analytically that for any even a small squish in the weak coupling limit, this instability is there. It's only when it's perfectly isotropic that the magnetic field doesn't grow.
Well, I don't understand one point. You have as many positive charges as negative charges.
Yes, you can play the same game for the negative charges.
So presumably to opposite effect.
Yeah. It will
kill.
No.
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 You will count the same thing. You
will count the same thing. No. And you have to change the right-hand rule because the current for the negative guys is the opposite direction.
Yeah, so stand on that side.
And, or use your left hand, I don't know. No, the negative charges don't kill it.
But I couldn't understand, so you're saying even isotropic distribution would have small deviations from it would be unstable?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But then it becomes, for very small deviations, it becomes a delicate question of what's the instability growth rate versus the collisional time scale. If the collisional time scale and this instability growth rate are numerically on the same order of magnitude, then they won't develop.
Okay, so there is still a minimum anisotropy that you need in order
yes.
for real instability.
The principle
to occur.
Is always there.
No.
Because otherwise the system would not be stable.
Right.
The isotropic system would...
There's a minimal one where you have to kick it above.
Yeah.
The function tries to isotropize the system. There's no...
Well, it doesn't run away. It's not a runaway instability. It tries to drive the system back to the stable point. You pull it away, you make it isotropic, it tries to go exponentially fast back to isotropic. Once it's isotropic, it oscillates around there.
Still, first of all, it goes away from isotropy. If later it isotropic, it gets isotropic again, I don't care.
Yeah.
But it would just tell if such an instability is present that the isotropic situation is not stable. And I don't think that can be true.
No, it doesn't say that it's not stable, actually. Even if it was, if you were to go to alpha s is 10 to the minus 12, okay, just as a talking point, there would be an instability, even for a very, very small deviation from equilibrium. Now, these fields would be generated, and it would try to drive it back to the isotropic case. It might overshoot it and make it more prolate. That introduces another instability in the other direction, which tries to drive it back. And it oscillates around the... It's a stable fixed point of instability in some sense, the isotropic state.
In effect, these instabilities isotropize the system.
Yes.
Much faster than scattering events. The origin looks very non-equilibrium.
But not immediately. I mean, first it's... once you have a mode that is growing away from isotropy, maybe it will later go back or something like that.
I mean, the other thing you have to worry about is time scales. If alpha s is 10 to the minus 12...
I think this is a central argument that actually for the very very close to isotropy, you have the scattering that will then dominate and stabilize the system.
Yeah, for that, you should look at the paper with Bjorn and I.
Easier to understand in context of QE. If you have an electron current, which is slightly non-isotropic, it's not stable. I mean, you will keep magnetic fields from the magnetic, and then you have that's the instability, exactly. And the equilibrium state is that you have some kind of fluctuations of magnetic fields and fluctuations of current. I mean, it's kind of thermal state then. But the magnetic field has to be there, and it's caused by this instability.
It's always when you start with an initial state that's somehow anisotropic. If you linearize response around the isotropic equilibrium, of course you will not find any unstable mode.
Right, but any small deviation from that, if the background is...
Linearize around an isotropic background,
it's completely stable.
Higher order, I guess, yeah.
If you linearize around an isotropic background, completely stable. Linearize around a slightly anisotropic background, not stable. But yes, there's a finite anisotropy.
But the direction of this, and let's say we start with the Prolet distribution, right? Then the filaments would be aligned with the Prolet direction.
Right, in a Prolet distribution, which is this cigar-shaped distribution.
So,
if you have a Prolet distribution, the unstable modes grow in that way. You have an oblate distribution and push out this way. So in either case, they push out to try to restore the isotropy.
But this figure, in this argument, quantitative argument, it does indicate the formation of filaments which are along the direction of the momentum distribution.
If you turn this way and then put a magnetic fluctuation this way, the same thing happens. If it was a cigar or a prolate distribution like this, this particular magnetic fluctuation would be stable.
This direction.
Yeah.
In this direction.
But the one in this direction would be unstable. Now, you could argue around with diagrams like this all day. I mean, it's useful for understanding the kind of intuitive level understanding of things. In the end, what you have to do is what Paul and I did. You find the polarization tensor, and then you vary it to C, and you make it negative or positive, and you see what happens. Yeah. So just to show you what would happen at least in this hard loop limit in an anisotropic abelian plasma, you would, if you started out with some small field fluctuations and then some particles in this prolate distribution, you would find after some short time that you start generating exponentially large magnetic fields and also exponentially large transverse fields. This is due to the fact that unstable growth rate for the magnetic field is above one for the electric field, but they're approximately the same. And you don't generate, on average, any longitudinal fields in this case. Again, this will continue to grow until essentially the deflections of the particles in these background fields invalidates all of the assumptions of the model that you had. And at that point, you basically just need to put it on a computer and solve it. Now, what we've been focusing on for the last few years is, well, what happens at this particular scale? Well, here I've just scaled it by some nice well, this M infinity is related to this Debye mass by some constant factor, and G. This is essentially when in the covariant derivative, the derivative term and the interaction term become on the same order. At that point, you can't ignore the commutator term coming from the covariant derivative. And this is basically the place where all these non-abelian effects would kick in. If you only had a description in terms of the polarization tensor, you wouldn't be able to describe this late time phase. So you need to go beyond the polarization tensor. And the way you do that, I could give a whole lecture about that, but basically you just require gauge invariance. You take that polarization tensor that you have, you rewrite it in terms of a Lagrangian and just the two-point function in that Lagrangian. If you did that, you would get a term that looks like the first term down here, except for in the bottom you would have a normal derivative instead of a covariant derivative. And then you just sort of invoke gauge invariance by taking that normal derivative and turning it into a covariant derivative. You can play the same game with the quarks. And what you get is the action for the soft fields, which to get, well, from these hard loops, which then if you sum that together with the bare QCD Lagrangian, gives you an effective Lagrangian for your soft fields. This effective Lagrangian is highly non-local. It contains an infinite number of interaction terms because you have to expand this covariant derivative out order by order, and you generate modifications of 2, 3, 4, and so on. There's a trick which we use to take this extremely non-local effective action and turn it into a local one. Essentially, you introduce a new field, which is F mu nu P nu over one of these inverse covariant derivatives. And this is something we call in our little community the W field. It's an auxiliary field which depends on space and also the free velocity. So you replace this incredibly non-local action by a local one coupled to essentially an infinite number of these auxiliary fields. This W field physically represents the average color current at the point X flowing in the direction V.
So like you said, this was kind of the logical thing to do, but this is still somehow the Hartree loop effective theory. So
yes.
So the kinetic, it would still be kind of the Vlasov equation.
Yes, I'll come back to that later.
So logically, you would also think you may have improved collisions.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. So at this point, we were just trying to address what happens in the extremely weak coupling limit, in which case we can ignore the collisions. We can also ignore the deflections of the hard particles. Essentially, these W's are just hard particles flying along iconal trajectories, having small angle deflections, and they radiate off the soft.
But just for the logic, and so far everything is classical. It's collision is glass. It's classical field theory, if you like. There's nothing quantum in there for the high momentum particles. So what you could do in principle is just take a classical statistical field theory simulation if you had a large enough lattice. So it's just classical statistical field theory. And if you do simulations with classical statistical field theory, you will always find these instabilities.
Yeah, but yeah, there are hard particles here. So I don't know exactly what you mean. I mean, the soft field fields are classical, but...
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're going to talk about this next week, right?
I mean, this is a kinetic description without collisions, but the kinetic parts are the hard particles.
Yeah, but it's without collisions, so...
Yeah, it's without collisions, fine.
There's nothing.
But if they...
You could equally...
They obey quantum statistics.
These classical description as also using fields at very high momentum.
Yeah.
So there are no collisions that could tell
no
you that
it's quantum. No, that's fine, but...
No, I mean, your point is well taken, and we've worked hard. And what I'm showing you now is essentially 4 years old. And in the interim, we've done all of the things that you should do, including collisions, including back reaction of the particles flying in their backgrounds. I'll come to that, but I won't be able to discuss all of it. So what results after you introduce these auxiliary fields W? Basically, this is the definition of that W. If you move this covariant derivative over here, it'll look like the half of that effect of Lagrangian. Essentially, the effect of Lagrangian is just a quadratic in this W field. So now you express the induced currents in terms of these W fields, and then you couple these W fields to their definition, essentially, and then you have to couple that current, which is generated by the W fields, back to the Yang-Mills equation, and then you have to solve this numerically. In practice, since there's an infinite number of these W fields at every point on your lattice, you have to also make a discretization in velocity space. And there's a couple of different ways in the literature in which this is done. One way is to expand the W field in YLM modes and then write down equations of motion for the YLM modes. The way that we did it was to simply take this velocity sphere, which is just a unit sphere where these fields live on, and just discretize it like a disco ball. We just put 100 points on there equally spaced around. And then we just solve for their equations of their time evolution. What you find is this picture shown here. This is for a rather, I guess, moderate anisotropy. So you have on the order of, I think, the square root over here, five times more transverse momentum than longitudinal momentum, three, something like that. At early times, I don't show it, this is on a linear scale now. At early times, this thing was growing exponentially, just like in the abelian case. You can prove that it should do that analytically. But at late times, this exponential growth turns off. Add an energy density here, which is on the order of 1, 8, something like that, in terms of this non-abelian scale. So this is when the non-abelian interactions kick in. And what you find at late times is not exponential growth, but some slow linear growth, and the fields are approximately isotropic. And they become more isotropic as time goes on. Now this is nice in a sort of theoretical aspect, because the point at which they saturate and start growing linearly is still within the bounds of your effective theory. They're still only undergoing order G deflections, the particles, and so you can continue to apply the effective theory that we've developed. One interesting thing that happens if you now take the field configurations, which here I've just shown the energy density as a function of time, and then you extract something like an occupation number from, say, Fourier transform gauged fixed, Coulomb gauge fixed E fields, you'll find a picture that looks like this. This bottom line down here is my starting field spectrum, essentially electric field spectrum. I just put some very, very tiny, soft momentum field fluctuations with a cutoff here in momentum space. At first, what you see is the growth of this unstable mode. This should look like that upside down parabola to you. But then at this point right here, you see that it stops growing and you start cascading energy very rapidly out to the UV. And in the end, if you run it long enough and you measure the spectrum here in this final linearly growing phase, you get a spectrum here indicated by this final red line, which drops like 1 on k squared. So it's not classically thermal. Classically thermal would be 1 on k. It's something else. And the something else is people have tried to make the connection to Kolmogorov cascades or turbulent fields. The way you can think about this in terms of freshman level physics is these turbulence develops. You have, say, a free flowing water and you introduce some obstacle. As you go right beyond the obstacle, you generate two large eddies. And as you follow the thing down the river, so forward in time, those two big eddies break up into four smaller eddies, and then eight smaller eddies. And eventually you get a bunch of little tiny eddies. That's these guys. So I encourage you to come to see Kari's discussion tomorrow afternoon for more details and systematics on that. But I want to jump ahead to quickly describe to you how you could perhaps go beyond hard loops. So this hard loop approximation, which I've been talking to so far, only applies when we ignore the back reaction of the particles. So again, there's some order g deflection of the particles, and not more. So how can we go beyond hard thermal loops, or in this case, hard loops? Well, you can include it by solving the at first step, the collisionless transport equation without linearization. Again, here for first pass, I just set the collisions to zero here. And now this is my full Boltzmann-Vlasov equation. In practice, what we do is we take this distribution function and we expand it into a bunch of test particles. So there's some number of test particles per physical particle, and it's a sum of delta functions, a delta function in momentum space, a product of delta functions, and then some product delta in momentum space, in real space, and a delta function in charge, because the charge changes as a function of time as they're flying around. And then you write down, you expand that out, and what you get is something called the Wong equations, which the first two are trivial. It's just the momentum update in the field and the position update in the field, essentially. And the third one describes how the color charge Q rotates as the particle is flying around the lattice. And then, as we did before, we have to take those particles and then couple them back to Yang mills. In practice, we don't use these point-like test particles. We use something which is smeared out for numerical simulations. And what happens when these guys are flying around? So if this guy's flying this way, he feels some force from the wall here. That might deflect him a little bit. That force induces a magnetic field on the wall here. The magnetic fields are kept tracked through Plaquette variables, so the Yang-Mills part of everything is done in a gauge invariant way. And then you have these particles which fly around and induce the fields. So you can do that, and that's what I did with Adrian Dimitru and Yasushi Nora. And now on fully three-dimensional lattice with hundreds of thousands of these test particles flying around. And again, what you find in this case as well, not including collisions, but now solving the full Boltzmann transport, is that for some time, you're waiting for the unstable modes to kick in, and then they grow exponentially, and then they saturate. And it's very similar to the picture that you get from the hard loop case. One thing that we have noticed in these simulations, though, is that this final amplitude seems to increase as the lattice spacing decreases. So at this point in time, we don't really have a continuum limit for this. So we currently don't know how large that field goes, and that's just a computational problem. Now, if you look at the spectrum which are generated here, it's just Coulomb gauge fixed B fields. At early times, it's this blue line, again, just soft modes. You generate an instability, hit this kind of purple line, and then this 15.5 is right in the middle of this growth. You've grown these soft fields by a factor of 10,000, and they have some big soft mode peak. But then this peak avalanches down, and you get what looks like a kind of quasi-thermal spectrum at late times.
I mean, this point about ultraviolet, isn't this just the effect of having a classical simulation in respect to an ultraviolet catastrophe?
Well, the ultraviolet catastrophe happens, would not happen in an abelian plasma. If we did the same run, but then in an abelian case, and then what you see is just these soft modes grow, and they grow, and they grow, and they grow. And eventually the back reaction turns them off, but you never see this cascade to the UV.
You just happen not to reach the lattice space.
Yeah, we never actually become sensitive. But in this case, in QCD, it seems that this avalanche, due to this kind of turbulent cascade, very quickly populates the highest modes on your lattice, and basically you can't...
Because you have to do quantum statistics.
Yeah, then you would have to do quantum statistics out there, and then...
But it was remarkable, it's not suspected that this is only relevant, say, at 20.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's very rapid.
If you do simulations just in the classical statistical theory, you also don't see the dependence of this at all on the instrumentation. So not using particle description at high momentum, the separation of scale, and then some field description at low momentum, which is a kind of model, of course.
Mm-hmm. If you don't know the particle, but also don't know when the stability stops.
No, we currently don't know. I mean, So what we have to do, unfortunately, so this was on a 64 cube lattice. Going to even 128 cube required us to rewrite the code and parallelize it. Now it runs on 32 machines at once, and that's just to get to 128 cube.
You said that when you lower the lattice
spacing,
the plateau goes up?
Yep. It goes up.
So the time, the instability will last longer.
Yeah. So the fields generated will be stronger.
Also you can your
yes.
Approach.
Well, I mean, this is for. Yeah. So let me try to give you some real numbers. So this n infinity, you should think of as some number on the order of 2J. Here we had to take it small just because of numerical. Restrictions. We just can't put as many of these test particles flying around as we would like, just because of computational restrictions. But if you scale it up, this should be some number on the order of the 2J. So this is 1 Fermi over C, 2 Fermi over C.
So you can say that characteristic growth rates.
Yeah, if it was really 0.12, this would be a long time. But that's just a fact that we can't pump this up. This needs to go up by another order of magnitude, and we just don't have the computational resources to do that currently.
And if it lasts too long, don't you have to include collision or something?
Yeah, we do that now. So I won't have time to tell you, but maybe we can have a discussion. Well, you're not here for very long. We could have an informal discussion about how we do that. What we do is now we include 2-to-2 scattering of our test particles with an infrared cutoff, which is the largest mode on our lattice, the highest mode on our lattice.
Okay, I can volunteer. Because tomorrow I'm going to show similar picture and we have very lucky station by one order of magnitude.
Yeah.
And really the growth just it seems to keep on growing as you make lucky station fine. But the growth happens because you populate more UV modes. Mm-hmm. At the infrared it's the same. I mean it's lucky spacing integrated. So that it's able to somehow populate UV modes very quickly.
I would be happy to have discussions with people. I mean, what we have been discussing in Frankfurt is a kind of way that essentially you would just go to these high momentum modes once you had populated them. You would subtract them out essentially by turning them into particles again, because they're too hard to be described by the lattice. Those would go back into the test particles, and then you would keep doing this. Because as soon as you remove these high guys, the soft field starts growing again. So you can just sort of...
I mean, at some point, there's probably the separation of scale. If you think of particles that might not be of course, they populate in the media point, and then the description breaks
down. Yeah, in our case, it's supposed to kind of... let's say ideal test case, so that you have infinite separation of scales, so it's all more hard particles are really, really hard. But
One point which is relevant in this connection is that, I mean, for Rick, the evidence right now is only that stuff is isotropized up to 2JeV. So you don't have to isotropize the hardest particles in the system. You only have to isotropize maybe the up to 1JeV or 2JeV. And those are some of those guys are the ones that you can describe using these field inks. And as you can see, they're approximately isotropic at late times. Now, actually extending that up to the scale 2JeV requires big computers.
Have you looked at the special distributions fields? Here you're showing momentum.
Yeah.
Fourier.
Yeah, I mean, I have some movies in which they develop. And during this period, you see these stripes, which if you cut the lattice in this direction, so this is the beam line where the anisotropy, if you cut it this way, you see current filaments, magnetic fields wrapping around the current filaments exactly like you would get from the Jackson level understanding. But then at late times, those sheets of currents and magnetic fields that are going around break up, and they sort of rejoin this way. I didn't include the movie. I should have, I guess. So there have also been studies of this within classical Yang Mills. So you don't include any particles at all. What you do is you initialize some fields with an anisotropic stress energy tensor, so they only have some pressure in the transverse direction and not in the longitudinal direction. In this case, it was done in a an expanding background, so a free streaming expanding background. So imagine you take your matter and put it in a box which is expanding at the speed of light in one direction. Analytically, you kind of expect this to modify the growth rate from being exponential of tau to exponential of square root of tau. The way to understand this is that this longitudinal expansion depletes the densities, which lowers this Debye mass, and you have to integrate essentially over that time, and what pops out is a square root of tau instead of tau, but it doesn't turn it off. And these simulations that I show here are from Paul and Raju Venugopalan using their classical Yang mills. And here they've initialized with very, very small longitudinal pressures at the initial time. And then they try to measure the growth rate for these modes. And up to a factor of 2, it agrees with the hard loop calculation. Now, Paul and Tony Rebhan have also formulated this in the Boltzmann-Vlasov case, which I'll come to in a couple of slides. And there are people now trying to understand what is a realistic spectrum of these initial fluctuations. So right now, numerically, we just have some arbitrary spectrum, some arbitrary amplitude. We vary it, and we see what the effect does. To get things quantitative, you really have to know what is that initial spectrum. So there's a bunch of people working on that as well. And recently, coming out of Darmstadt, people have gone to just a non-expanding classical Yang-Mills situation. Again, you just initialize an anisotropic stress energy tensor, and then you try to measure the growth of some modes. And this is some low momentum mode, some higher momentum mode, and some even higher momentum mode. At first, they grow exponentially here, 12 orders of magnitude. This is this low mode, which would be in that primary unstable band. So they call these primaries. And then these black guys, they call secondaries. And they're induced by the fact that you had some soft mode, which has grown to such a scale that now the nonlinear interaction in your equation of motion kicks in. And then they start growing at twice the rate or four times the rate. And similar things are seen if you do this hard loop. So you have some primary mode, secondary modes, tertiary modes, whatever you want to call it. These guys grow incredibly fast.
So you might hope that getting even faster growth means faster isolation.
And that's the power of primary.
You can't have initial conditions that trigger these secondaries early on, just giving, for instance, a longitudinal width. But if you look for physical observables like pressure, the question is pressure as it becomes faster, it's not really giving much. It's rather insensitive to initial conditions, the presence of even faster time scales.
But the secondary, what you call secondary states, power from the primary, and they wouldn't exist for the primary.
Yeah, but you can make them starting earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, so the take-home message from this is that although, analytically we can describe the time evolution of this primary unstable mode, in order to get all these nonlinear effects and everything, you have to work hard numerically. And there are many groups now around the world doing that. And then finally, I have a couple of slides on some recent work that I'm doing with Tony Rebhan and student Maximilian Adams on doing essentially what Paul did, but now from a Boltzmann-Vlasov treatment. So we assume that we have some color-neutral background distribution function, F0, which is a function of P and X and time, of course. And then we impose this free-streaming condition on it. So all this means is that I've now taken my particles and I put them in a box, which is expanding at the speed of light out this way. And I ignore the back reaction of the fields in this limit on these guys, which are expanding out. What that means is that this Cassi parameter increases as a function of time. Initially, you have an isotropic plasma at that point around the formation time, but as time evolves, it becomes more and more and more and more anisotropic, and the unstable modes become band gets wider and wider and wider, and more modes become unstable in the system. So it's not exactly clear at late times if in such a expanding background this would agree with this hard loop spectra that you get, this linear rising and Kolmogorov cascade.
But let's say this is a one-dimensional
expansion. One-dimensional expansion.
Rather than, say, a European expansion, radially.
Yeah, it's not radial, no. It's just one-dimensional expansion. I assume that these guys aren't changing their momentum this way, but they're just getting redshifted out due to the one-dimensional expansion. Again, you just have to write down your Boltzmann-Vlasov equation and couple those fluctuations back to the F. So the trick that Paul and Tony wrote up, I guess about a year and a half ago, is to, what we would all naturally do, go to co-moving coordinates, rewrite all of these equation of motion in tau and eta. So you get some metric now for your physics, which is just the standard metric, which European metric with a tau squared here. And then you can just rewrite the equations of motion for the Yang-Mills field in this metric, tilde means in these moving coordinates. And then you get very similar equations. They're more complicated to write down, but in essence, they're the same. You have some update equation for these auxiliary fields W. Those auxiliary fields W then generate the induced current. And then you couple that induced current back to the time evolution of the Yang-Mills field in that expanding metric. One thing that's technically different and presents some difficulties is that in the non-expanding case, this integral here that appears for these W fields is over a compact sphere. You have a sphere, really, and now it's a cylinder. So instead of doing what we called disco balls in the old days, we have to do now disco cylinders. And you have to put some cutoff in here, and then maybe there's sensitivity to the cutoff in the end. There's not, but it's not exactly trivial how you discretize this particular integral. So you do it in the naive way you would first do it, and then you try to make some first results. The results that I show you here are from what we call 1S3V. 3V just means all the particles are flying around in all three spatial directions as they like, but then we impose, first to make things simple, the condition that the fields don't depend on the transverse direction. They only depend on this longitudinal or eta direction in this case. The reason this is done is that because this captures the physics of the most unstable modes, those are the ones that are like this, and it will provide a reference point for going to the full 3S, three spatial dimensions and three velocity dimensions simulations. Here I plot the time evolution of the total, and then you can look at the individual field components if you want, but since we're lacking time here, you initialize some small field energy density. At first, the expansion tends to deplete the field energy. It's just expanding over space, so nothing happens. If you didn't have these particles coupled back in to generate the fields, this would just keep going down. And all of the energy in the field would go to zero at times again. But at some point, this turns around, and you start generating incredibly large fields. And in these 1S3V simulations, it continues to grow exponentially with this e to the square root of tau. You can also then measure how much longitudinal pressure is generated by these fields, how much transverse pressure is generated by these fields. And you generate exponentially large longitudinal pressure, which is trying to blow these particles out this way. So trying to restore the isotropy.
But they're not really coming together, no?
These two are not coming together. Well, this is because it's this 1S3V simulation. This is, in some sense, almost abelian, although you do generate these longitudinal field components. They're much smaller than by orders of magnitude than these transverse ones. So it's effectively abelian in this case. And as I showed you the spectrum before, you can then now do spectra in eta instead of in the conjugate momentum to eta. And what you find are two pictures like this. On the left, I show you what would happen if you initialized all the fields aligned in one color direction, so all commutators vanish and you just have abelian evolution of the fields. In that case, this thing just grows like exponential square root of tau. You never even see a little dip. It just grows like exponential square root of tau. That's these soft modes growing exponentially. If you look closely, they're not evenly spaced. They're getting closer and closer. That's the square root of tau instead of tau. And out here is basically just noise. It's white noise. Nothing grows out here. You can calculate the growth rate according to Kari. I haven't actually done it for these guys out here by coupling this into some just noise term. I mean, this is a numerical artifact. You can do the same thing now turning on the non-abelian interactions, and what you find is, well, yeah, at first these low modes are the ones growing, but then you reach this blue line here, which is this point here on my plot where all field components become approximately the same magnitude, which we call the non-abelian point. And in that point, surprisingly, you get a kind of quasi-thermal distribution, which then looks like it's heating up. If you look at each of these lines, they're basically aligned in this log versus low number. And like in the other simulations, you see it cascade to higher and higher modes. Eventually, you start populating the highest modes on your lattice, and all of your control parameters, like Gauss log, go crazy. So you can't run to very, very late times. But it's quite interesting that you get what looks like quasi-thermal spectrum.
But it's not isotropic.
It's not isotropic at this point, no. Well, actually, it's very close to isotropic at that point right there. Yeah, the pressure actually is also quite isotropic at that point.
But then
it goes away. This is an artifact of this one spatial dimension approximation, which is going to be relaxed. So we have to...
Oh, isn't it the only fields that you're showing?
It's only the fields. I mean, also the...
whole energy momentum tensor has contributions of fields and particles, and the particles have just the other way. Mm-hmm. So then in total, it goes towards a subfield.
Yeah, I mean, at this non-abelian point, pressures are almost isotropic. The spectrum is quasi-thermal. This out here, again, is just noise. These lines start forming very early. If you look carefully.
I didn't understand. They start deviating on the previous line. The other one, they start deviating again.
Yes.
That's a numerical artifact, you think?
It's not a numerical artifact. It's an artifact of our assumption in order to make the numerics tractable.
We
have rapidity dependence, but no transverse dependence of the fields right now. Yeah, but that will be relaxed. We like to move slowly and do fast. Okay. So anyway, I hope that I convinced you today, or at least gave you evidence, that anisotropic plasmas are qualitatively different than isotropic ones. You get these unstable modes. They grow faster in the weak coupling limit than the collisional time scale, and so in that limit you can ignore them. In the hard loop limit at late times in the non-expanding case, in the full three-dimensional simulations, late times the fields show isotropic and linear growth and an associated UV cascade that looks like something like turbulence. And from the CPIC, so solving Boltzmann-Vlasov quote-unquote exactly, we also see rapid isotropic field growth followed by a UV avalanche and also isotropic fields. Classical Yang-Mills people have also been working hard, and they've shown that rapidity fluctuations then grow exponentially in time, and so the CGC, or what Larry likes to call the plasma these days, is unstable to becoming a quark-gluon plasma. So whether you could really call it a state of matter, I would say no. And then as Jürgen and Denish and company have shown, these instabilities are also seen in the static box in the classical Yang-Mills case. For this crowd, I come to this fifth point here. This same instability exists in weakly coupled supersymmetric gauge theories. The only thing that changes is the expression for the Debye mask. You just have different Casimirs appearing there. So the question is, do these instabilities exist in the strong coupling limit? How would you even set up the problem that you would have an anisotropic initial state on the boundary of your space, and then how would you fall in time? I encourage people to drop by and give us ideas. Looking towards more phenomenological things, we've been working hard to assess what are the possible phenomenological effects of these plasma instabilities. What would happen to jets propagating in such a background? What would be the effect on dileptron production, on photon production, and all of these things? And then finally, we work hard to include collisions as well. So thanks for your attention.
Let me come back to this question of isotropization, because you're often saying things get isotropic at late times or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the real crucial question is probably simply at what time the longitudinal and the transversal pressure components get, let's say, equal up to 10% deviation. Then you can probably use hydra approximately. Mm-hmm. Do you have any estimate of this time scale? And can you see, you know, if you really
currently
your curves, at what time the pressure gets, let's say, within 10% equal in the two components?
Well, I mean, I can answer that question for you now. So here's that point in time. And actually, if this was a 3D simulation, this would basically lock into the isotropic situation at late times. So I can answer that question now, but it depends on what the initial condition is. So
let me say something to this. So up to this calculation here, I think nobody really achieved isotropization in all momentum ranges in a reasonable time. So for instance, if you just do plastic,
I don't need all momentum
yes,
range,
what you
just
find
pressure. Just pressure.
But take the energy momentum tensor, which is space-time dependent. Yeah. And you may get from this a time-dependent pressure, and you also may ask for a coarse-grained pressure. So you may ask, is pressure for low momentum isotropic in a short time? And the answer is yes, that you can achieve. So if you just look for low momentum range, the coarse-grained pressure, then you can get an isotropic equation of the state rather quickly. If you ask, do you go with this coarse-grained scale to high momentum, to ask for complete isotropization would take very, very long, or 100. Since you want to ask whether hydro works, hydro works for low momentum. So yes, in a range of maybe 1 GeV up to 2 GeV transverse momentum, you can assume from this calculation that you get an isotropic equation of state, but not for higher momentum.
I would say hydrodynamics, that involves the full pressure. Mm-hmm. Because it's conservation laws, essentially. So you cannot easily into low momentum modes and high momentum modes. I mean, hydro...
Christoph, hydro will not describe the very high momentum mode. We know it experimentally. It's on jets and...
But they are not contributing to pressure.
Yeah, that's so far as it makes sense. But if you think of isotropies, this is what you see. Just think of the volume and you average over it, and in this, you know, coarse-grained view, you see a perfectly isotropic equation at stake. Just if you go to smaller and smaller distance scales to the details, you find it's not isotropic.
Well, the pressure in any scale is given by an ultraviolet mode. So, I mean, those are by far the most interesting, the most momentum. So.
If you are in equilibrium, then it's given by pressure, by momentum, of all of the temperature.
Yes.
You see, these timescales at which we find, say, isotropization for characteristic low momentum scales, that is not done. It's far from it.
Yeah, sure. Yes. Absolutely.
Your argument just would apply if you are in equilibrium and you have the Bose-Einstein distribution?
I would really guess that this, the modes with momentum of the order of the temperature will determine the hydrodynamics.
That depends on your distribution, but this is a distribution that's far from thermal. At that point where you see...
But then anyhow, then it will be the peaks, it will always be the modes, that your distribution is peaked. Okay, for thermal this is near the temperature, for some other distribution it's somewhere else. But the important
thing is... But let me say where somewhere else is. He was talking about Kolmogorov time spectrum. That's a power law. That's strongly peaked in the infrared.
Yeah. But I don't really care what the exact distribution is. I'm just saying pressure has a nice property. It really, it just tells you already which are the modes that are contributing most. And since you have conservation equations that are used for hydrodynamics, you really want to know the total pressure. I don't care so much what is the underlying distribution into particle modes or whatsoever. Whenever I have conservation of energy momentum tensor and I can have an isotropic pressure, I'm almost there for hydrodynamics. The rest is then just the dissipation terms. But this is a real crucial point. And this is the number I want to get. I want to know when is pressure isotropic within 10%.
The answer would be 100 Schrödinger.
But this is a catastrophe.
Well, no, but if you...
Here the answer is 5. This scale is 10 Fermi University.
But it's only the fields.
This is only the fields, but the particles have a finite transverse pressure and a small negative longitudinal pressure at this time, which basically just brings these two together.
Then it's as bad as
possible. But the particles practically are responsible for the pressure.
You start with an initial condition where you have high occupation numbers in the transverse plane for low momentum. So it will cascade to the UV, but it will take time. And at the time where you have attractive pressure, what's called isotropization, you didn't occupy the high momentum numbers. So I disagree strongly with what Christoph said, that it doesn't depend on the distribution how you get your effective pressure that you put into hydrodynamics. If you have a distribution that's strongly peaked in the infrared, and if you're far from equilibrium, you may have a very stable equation of state, but that's dominated not by hard modes, but by some modes at low momentum. And there you find very fast isotropization.
But you will not have a conservation of energy momentum tensor separately for the low modes. I mean, all this hydrodynamic is based on energy momentum conservation.
It's true that's how you derive the equations, but then you put in, by hand, an equation of state. That equation of state we may be able to calculate by simulations. And this equation of state can be obtained, for instance, for low momentum modes. It's not that deriving the hydrodynamics from the continuity equation means that the equation of state you put in comes from the same energy conservation law. For instance, what Paul Schau does uses two different equation of states for the Quark-Gluon phase and for the Hadron phase. He just switches from one to the other.
I still think things are much simpler.
The hydrodynamics don't have to do with the terms that are present in the Stokes equation. They have to do with terms in the black. And some of them are angular derivatives, and some of them are radial derivatives. And you're discussing both of them at the same time. You're saying, over a large scale, that the neglect radial derivatives that have a degradation of curve by the
Still, I mean, you could have, of course, in principle, a situation where you have some subcomponents approximately conserved, which I actually, when I see these curves, I don't think that is actually true. Otherwise, the only thing that you have in hydrodynamics is really energy momentum conservation. And there are two important ingredients.
Energy is exactly conserved here, and also even more so in our CPIC simulations.
Energy momentum conservation in the sense of, just a conserved team you knew. This is the essential ingredient, plus some statements about dissipation. So dissipation is, we can relatively, that's maybe reasonable to say we can neglect that. But then we still have the big problem that energy momentum conservation gives hydrodynamics only if your pressure is isentropic. The equation of state between pressure and energy density, this goes very quickly to equilibrium numbers. This is just a sentence. This goes to a third, it's just that you have massless modes. So this is achieved very simply. But what is difficult to achieve is the same, is a microscopic equation of state where transverse and longitudinal momenta are equal. Pressures, sorry, not momenta, pressures are equal.
Hydrodynamic simulations are much more robust in the sense that they don't start from a big field theory, derive the hydrodynamics from as a low energy description, and get all their transport coefficients from the same theory. No, they first derive hydro using energy conservation. And then you take from some other estimates or some calculations, you take your transport coefficients. They're not directly related. There's no contradiction in having energy conservation and just having an equation of state that's isotropic on large scales only. There's no contradiction.
Let me phrase it simply. Longitudinal and transversal pressure are different by a factor of 3. I would never believe you that the hydrodynamic simulation gives you a correct result. Sure. I just can't see how to do that. So I think it is a crucial quantity that your pressure components are roughly equal.
And that's what we're working on.
And then you have to estimate the time scale when that happens. And pressure cycles itself.
I'll tell you where the end of the road is, right? So this is now expanding, so as close as we can get to the realistic situation. These are the fields. Right now we ignore the back reaction. So the next thing is to take the CPIC code, which includes the back reaction.
Make it all go faster.
I mean,
and you're also limited, I guess.
I agree with you 100%. You have to numerically, quantitatively calculate when is that time scale when the pressures become approximately isotropic within 10%. And we're working towards that goal in a systematic way.
The earlier estimates at the beginning of your talk was that this was going to happen very rapidly. But now in this simulation, it's taking
what? Again, this comes back to the initial conditions, and there's lots of quantitative issues here. This is not 50, this is 5 Fermi over C, and I started from an initial condition, actually, that has zero transverse momentum and only longitudinal momentum. So I had to wait, basically the time I had to wait was for this thing to grow exponentially from zero up to there. Now, the only reason this is the case is because of this 1S3V simulation. So we don't have any transverse fluctuations. So we don't have any transverse pressure to begin with. Once we relax that assumption, you won't have to wait as long for this to become approximately isotropic. In some sense, this is the worst case scenario.
Okay. I mean, just to add on this, isotropy is necessary for hydro, but it's not sufficient as well. You need also to measure an equation of state, and it has to be done in the pattern.
Right, but if, as but you're going to say, it's approximately conformal, and you believe,
then the equation of state is one third.
Yeah.
That's very quickly. I mean, we did that, Jürgen, actually. It was tough in very, very short time. It's just relativistic velocities. So energy over mean pressure, that goes very, very fast. It's just mean pressure is not yet isotropic pressure by definition.
But it goes fast also for this low momentum one?
Yeah, I think whatever you do.
Just massless.
It's just massless.
So if you wouldn't have the problem of isotropization, it's practically insignificant. Because it's just if you have a density particle, it's one third.
The equation of state is settled very, very fast. The only thing you really have to settle in order to make hydro reasonable is isotropization of pressure.
Usually hydro is local thermodynamic equilibrium.
No, not so much. There's much less really input. You can derive the essentials just from conservation equations.
No, the Curie equation of state conservation equation of overload.
It should be a small, I mean,
isotropy equation of state, you know, we get very rapidly, isotropization is missing. That's the only really missing piece in this.
The question of state, you can say, is present from the beginning, because also there's PV, so you take one cell of PV of C times P, and P is equal to E, you get one cell E.
Even if you start with some initial conditions, but it's not realized that it goes chunk.
That's just because you must.
So, and then of course, I like also dissipation. Some statements, but that is reasonable that they get the double or with something like that. Okay, now we have two discussions.
Now we have to end it. We can continue this tomorrow at 3:00 p.m.